Good afternoon. This is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, April 8th, 2021. On our show today, Senate Bill 3, the original bill addressing hate crimes in this session of the Arkansas General Assembly, finally made it to a committee yesterday. Its discussion was lengthy and tempers flared. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports. And later, Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek explains how legislation addressing transgendered Arkansans might have an effect on an upcoming cyclocross world championship scheduled to be held in Fayetteville. After today's Ozarks, KUAF has a Thursday edition of Here and Now. Today, a therapist who has dedicated his career to helping people cope with racialized trauma. Now he's working with the Minnesota Health Department to treat those suffering after the killing of George Floyd. He'll talk about his work on Here and Now from NPR, beginning at 1 this afternoon on KUAF. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art will increase the size of the Bentonville Museum by about 50%. The design of the addition is taking place now. Construction is expected to start early next year and be finished in 2024. The expansion will be a project of Softy Architects, the firm that helped create the museum that opened almost 10 years ago. A longtime Arkansas editorial writer and reporter who earned a Pulitzer Prize is dead. Paul Greenberg was awarded the Pulitzer while working at the Pine Bluff Commercial for his writing about civil rights. He later became synonymous with the editorial pages of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. He was 84. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 244 newly diagnosed cases of COVID-19 yesterday and reporting 7 new deaths from the virus. The ADH reports nearly 21% of Arkansans over 16 have been fully vaccinated. Another 15% are partially vaccinated. The Oklahoma State Department of Health is fixing a technical error with a reporting lab, and as a result, there was an increase in diagnosed cases in yesterday's reporting of about 1,300. Most of those positive cases, the department reports, were detected over a 6-week period, some dating back to December, and the department says those 1,300 cases do not represent a distortion of the risk of transmission to the public. The Cherokee Nation is distributing more than $6 million to more than 107 school districts as part of Public School Appreciation Day. The event has taken place since 2002. This year, the awards were made virtually. Each district makes their own decision how to spend the money. Westville School District in eastern Oklahoma using the money to help pay for COVID-19 protocols and a recently started driver's education program. The money is allocated based on the number of Cherokee Nation citizens enrolled in each district, but benefits all students in a district. Cloudy tonight, lows in the mid-50s. There is a 40% chance of rain tomorrow afternoon, with highs in the mid to upper 70s. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. Governor Asa Hutchinson has long advocated for the passage of hate crimes legislation in Arkansas, one of only 3 states without such legislation. 3 months into the 93rd General Assembly, lawmakers are finally making some moves. Senate Bill 3, a hate crimes bill filed in November, was presented to a committee yesterday. The legislation aims to enhance sentencing for offenses committed because of certain attributes such as race, religion, or sexual orientation. Discussion lasted for more than an hour and a half and ended with lawmakers trading insults. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Senator Joyce Elliott has been working on hate crimes legislation for decades. The Little Rock Democrat backed a hate crimes bill in 2001 that made it out of the Senate, but failed in a House committee after a group of clergy members spoke against the legislation because it included protections for sexual orientation. Elliott says the group offered to support the bill if that was removed, but she didn't agree to those terms.
That's why we don't have a hate crimes bill today. It's not because I was being stubborn. It was because I believe we all matter equally. And so 20 years later, there have been people other than just me who tried at this over the years. and it still hasn't happened. And I really hope when we do pass a hate crimes bill in Arkansas, it will be one where we are clear-eyed and nobody has to guess about what we mean. And do I have to try to figure out, am I covered, not covered under this bill?
Elliott is a co-sponsor of SB 3, which she presented to the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, and once again, the bill did not advance. Although the outcome was not unexpected, lead sponsor Senator Jim Hendren, an independent from Gravette, says it was important to have the discussion.
Something that somebody's worked on for decades deserves to be heard, and the people who are impacted most by these crimes deserve to be heard. So I appreciate the committee making it possible for us to present Senate Bill 3.
A group of Republicans filed Senate Bill 622 last week, which is being described as a class protection bill. Senator Linda Chesterfield, a Democrat from Little Rock, spoke in favor of SB 3, saying SB 622 doesn't do enough.
I've been fighting against the odds for a very long time in my life, and I know that I am fighting against the odds with this bill. But you gave us a placebo that made you feel better. But the dose is simply not strong enough.
Criticism of SB 622 includes not involving vulnerable communities in the drafting of the legislation, only addressing felonies, and for not identifying specific groups that would receive protection under the law. By contrast, Senator Hendren says he negotiated with stakeholders in crafting his legislation, which addresses misdemeanors and felonies, and defines traditional victims of hate crimes. SB 3 lists a bipartisan group of co-sponsors, while SB 622 does not.
I think it's more comprehensive. I think it's more appropriate. And the most important thing is this bill gives us the opportunity to pass a piece of hate crimes legislation that is bipartisan and that the people who are most impacted and continually be impacted by this year after year see as a real step forward.
Supporters like that SB 3 lists specific groups typically targeted in hate crimes, but opponents like Senator Bob Ballinger, a Republican from Ozark, are concerned about characteristics not included in the bill, like political beliefs.
People are wearing MAGA hats and getting the tar beat out of them because they're wearing a MAGA hat. You may not agree with their philosophy, mm-hmm. but the reality is a person shouldn't be attacked because they share some social or political or whatever view. I mean, if we're going to have a bill that targets hate, shouldn't it cover everyone?
If political affiliation is a concern for opponents of SB 3, Hendren says he has no problem including that language in his bill.
I've made the point, though, that this bill does protect everybody. Everybody has a race. Everybody has a gender. Most people have a religion. Everybody has a national origin. I mean, this bill covers us all equally. But it also tries to identify groups that have been traditionally targeted to the point of thousands per year, specifically to give them the message that we're tired of it and we're not going to tolerate it.
Family Council President Jerry Cox is the sole member of the public who spoke against the legislation. The organization has opposed these types of bills for years because, Cox says, they open the door for thought policing and create unequal justice.
If you list certain people that get more protection than others, you have created unequal justice. And again, I've always thought of us living in a country where no matter who you were, what you were, the law treated you equal. And that's what I believe we have. People have said certain people need to be protected. Well, yes, we all need to be protected, and I believe we all are. Show me where the laws are insufficient to punish evildoers.
Senator Elliott says hate crimes laws are not designed to legislate a person's ability to hate. They legislate the action someone takes based on that hate, per the definition of a hate crime, which Elliott says require there be a history and pattern identifiable by groups. She agreed with a committee member that in an ideal world, labels would be unnecessary. However, she says we live in a world where groups have been targeted because of certain attributes, so it's important to name them.
I don't want my identity erased so everything will be great. I want it to be okay to see me as a Black person and see my face and still be okay with me. But when you can't do that and you start criminalizing in some way by your actions just because of what you do see, I think that's the reason we're here.
After Hendren's motion to pass the bill did not receive a second, Senator Trent Garner made a motion that the committee do not pass the bill, which prevents legislation from being considered again. Senator Ballinger seconded the motion. During his 16 years in the Arkansas legislature, Hendren says he's only seen this happen one time.
It is the most hateful, petty thing that you can do to your colleagues. You have a bill before you with 19 of your colleagues as co-sponsor, with bipartisan support, with tremendous support from people that we represent. So I know you can do what you want to do, but I just want you to think about the message that something that petty will do.
Ballinger fired back, calling the whole process embarrassingly petty and self-serving.
It's a very bad bill, right? And that was brought to your attention. Those conversations were had. There was a lot of other things that was brought to the attention, but that wasn't your plan, Senator Hendren. Your plan was to make the news. Your plan was to become somebody real important. Your plan was to have this new idea of everybody coming together behind the man, Jim Hendren. And no matter what it did to your colleagues, no matter what it did to your colleagues, that was the direction you were going. I get it. I understand. And I hate the fact that all this is getting aired out. But the truth is, that's exactly what happened.
The do not pass motion failed on a roll call vote. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Yesterday afternoon, the Arkansas Senate advanced SB 622 by a vote of 22 yeas, 7 nays, and 5 voting present. The bill will be heard by the House Judiciary Committee this afternoon. During his weekly press briefing Tuesday, Governor Asa Hutchinson expressed support for the legislation.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is open each Wednesday through Monday. To maintain social distancing and follow COVID-19 safety protocols, free time ticket reservations are required for entry to the museum. No tickets are needed for the outdoor access of the museum's trails and grounds, which are open from sunrise to sunset. Tickets and more information available at crystalbridges.org. Arkansas Community Foundation handles back office administration so CPAs, attorneys, and other advisors can facilitate smart giving without establishing private foundations for clients. arcf.org/advise for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. In roughly the last month, the Arkansas legislature has proposed and passed several bills that LGBTQ activists say target the freedoms of transgender youth and athletes. Governor Asa Hutchinson signed two of those bills, the Fairness in Women's Sports Act, which bans trans women and girls from participating in publicly funded school and college sports, and the Medical Ethics and Diversity Act, which allows healthcare providers to refuse to give care to a patient on moral and religious grounds, except in an emergency. On Monday, Governor Hutchinson vetoed another bill passed by the legislature called the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act, which bans gender-affirming health care for trans youth. The majority Republican House and Senate swiftly overturned the veto the next day. Meanwhile, a bill that would require public school and college educators and staff to address trans students only by the name and sex cited on their birth certificate is going before the full House for a vote later this afternoon. In light of this legislation, cyclists from around the country and the world are calling on national and international governing bodies to move their events out of Northwest Arkansas. In the first of two reports, Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek speaks with several professional and amateur women cyclists to get their perspective on the increasing calls for a boycott.
I quite literally have become the poster girl for everyone who hates trans women in sport.
That's Veronica Ivey, formerly known as Rachel McKinnon, which is the name she was using when she became the first transgender woman to win a world title after competing in the 2018 UCI Masters Track Cycling World Championships in Los Angeles, where she represented her home country of Canada.
When you see cyclists on a little oval indoors on like a banked wood track, usually that's track cycling. That's what I do. I do the sprint events, max power, max speed. So we are hitting over 40 miles an hour, basically horizontal to the ground as we go around this two-story, 45-degree wood track. It is as crazy as it gets for cycling.
Ivy says her win also propelled her into another kind of limelight when American Jennifer Wagner Asali, who finished third, replied to a tweet about the race by writing, quote, "I was the third place rider. It's definitely not fair."
Even though she beat me in the time trial, and I've counted all the times we've raced each other because we've raced on the road, She beat me in 10 of 13 events. So she's beat me 10 out of 13 times and yet claims to credibly say that it's unfair for me to win the minority of times.
The second place cyclist from the Netherlands who lost to Ivy called the race honest under UCI rules for trans athletes. Wagner Asali eventually apologized for her original tweet, but is now a political activist on the issue. Here she is speaking with Julian Vigo during a February episode of the podcast Savage Minds. Throughout the interview, both women refer to Ivy using male pronouns.
We basically had a party after that one because McKinnon got fourth, and I think I may have beat him by like a tenth of a second or something like really tiny. So we were just elated that it was an all-woman podium, but we kind of were dreading the next one.
So you oppressed him then, in other words.
right, exactly. So yeah, we were the bad guys again.
Wagner Asali is one of a group of cisgender athletes who say trans women have an unfair advantage because of the physiological differences between the sexes. But Ivy says that's an oversimplification.
And they like to say, oh, look at her, she's so strong, therefore it's unfair. But sport is not that simple. Sport is not as simple as looking at a body and determining who has an advantage. People always forget that the range of bodies within a sex is much, much, much larger than the range or the average differences between sexes.
As of right now, Ivy says there's been no research conducted into the differences between trans and cis women who compete in elite level sports.
While I have two Masters World Championships, that is age category, age 35 to 39, my highest world elite ranking has been 85th. There is a woman who is 6'1", 205 pounds, taller and bigger than me. She has an Olympic gold medal. So we have a woman who is bigger and stronger and faster than me and is cisgender and has an Olympic gold medal, and I will never make it to the Olympics. And yet people think it's unfair for me to compete.
Ivy started considering she might be transgender around the time she hit puberty.
I was a 90s kid born in the 80s, and the media visibility of trans people was not a positive one. So I just didn't even consider it as an option, like literally did not consider that I could be trans. And that's what explained what I was feeling and wanting. So I figured that out finally at 29, right at the end of my PhD. And then I transitioned right at the end of my 20s.
She started racing bikes about 6 years later. And since then, like other trans athletes, she's had to adjust to a patchwork of policies in order to compete. In the U.S., the governing body known as USA Cycling or USAC has adopted a two-tiered policy. Non-elite racers can self-identify as men or women. For elite athletes, the organization adopted the same policies as the International Cycling Union, or the UCI, which adopted the same policies set out by the International Olympic Committee.
Therefore, the UCI, therefore the elite USAC policy is that trans women need to have suppressed their testosterone continuously for at least 12 months before their first competition, and they must be able to demonstrate that their testosterone is maintained below that level of 10 nanomoles per liter for their entire competitive career. If their testosterone ever tests above 10 nanomoles per liter, that 12-month clock starts over again.
That's the policy that went into effect in 2015. But Ivy says she started racing under more restrictive IOC guidelines from 2003, which required athletes to undergo genital surgery and wait 2 years before competing.
So if you've had genital surgery, you do not produce testosterone. So you kind of by default meet the newer policy. So since I started racing under that more restrictive policy, I immediately meet the newer less restrictive policy.
Both organizations are sanctioning the cycling events that will be taking place at Centennial Park in Fayetteville from now until January. That includes the U.S. Cup, an Olympic qualifier, which starts tomorrow and includes two back-to-back weekends of racing. Then in October, the city is set to host a Cyclocross World Cup as a prelude to the UCI Cyclocross World Championships that will take place in January. Ivy says USA Cycling and the UCI should pull their sanctioning of the events.
They need to stand by their policy, and there needs to be consequences for states that create laws that are in violation of an organization's principles of fairness and inclusion and their policies. They need to step up.
But Ivy's message to athletes about whether to support the events in Arkansas is more complicated, especially on the elite level, where athletes rely on races like these to make national teams and collect ranking points.
So I really understand how hard it is to skip out of an event that matters to your long-term career goals for taking a stand. For the non-elite athletes, I would say just don't go. If you have to travel for racing, just don't go to Arkansas to do your racing. Go somewhere else.
Sammy Runnels is a professional cyclist who moved to Bentonville from Austin, Texas a year ago, just as the COVID-19 pandemic moved into Arkansas.
Really, when I got on a bike and started competing, I just felt like there was this missing part of me, you know, like I was always kind of an aggressive person and like, you know, that's not usually good. But when you put that into sports, it can be really healthy. And so it really just became this like amazing outlet for me.
Runnels has now been racing for 8 years.
I actually participate in 4 disciplines. I've raced road and crits. I've raced cyclocross, mountain bikes, and fixed gears as well. But cyclocross is my main discipline right now.
She says she's excited to have several national level events happening in her backyard, but felt she had to make a statement about legislation that impacts fellow athletes. In a recent post on her Instagram, Runnels wrote she moved to Arkansas for the gravel roads and trails, but that doesn't mean she agrees with the politicians running the state. She goes on to say, quote, "These aren't laws to protect women's sports. These are laws designed to control people's bodies."
I've competed against trans athletes and, you know, I've beaten them, you know, I've beaten a hell of men too, you know, like I love competing. I want our sport to be inclusive and I want to compete with trans athletes.
Runnels says trans athletes in women's sports are not the problem, but sexual assault, lack of equal pay, and disparities in facilities, like those recently documented by NCAA women's basketball players, are. And while she understands why some athletes are planning to boycott upcoming events in Northwest Arkansas, Runnels says she also knows what goes into planning an event the scale of the World Championships.
Not that I don't think that there doesn't need to be a statement made, but I do understand like the logistics that go into an event this big. You know, like there should be like 30 to 50 countries that'll come to this event, which is why it's so important for them to make a statement.
Crystal Anthony is another professional cyclist who lives in the area. She races for the Live Racing Collective, which is a brand that builds bikes and designs gear specifically for women.
I've been to the World Championships 3 times to represent the U.S. in cyclocross. So I'm looking forward to racing some more cyclocross this year.
Anthony also made a statement on Instagram where she wrote about living in a cycling community that's striving to be more inclusive, while the state legislature appears to be heading in the opposite direction.
You know, there's organizations like Arkansas and Latinas in BC and Bike Talk and Women of Oz and all these wonderful people trying to bring more people into cycling, and obviously the infrastructure here makes it much more accessible than anywhere else that I've lived. So for the government to come out with legislation that is doing the opposite of that, I think is wrong. And I needed to say something about that.
She says it's been difficult to reconcile the work on the ground in Northwest Arkansas with the decisions that are being made on the state level.
It's a very tricky topic, because on the one hand, I don't want to discount what the legislation is doing, and that does encompass the whole state. At the same time, I don't want to write off all of Arkansas, because there are so many good things going on here. And I think the fact that cycling has become more prominent here is one of the reasons that so many people are aware of what's going on with this legislation.
And Anthony adds, for her, sport has always been a way of getting people together instead of driving them apart.
Sports is one place that, you know, you're suffering together, you're adventuring together, you're winning together, losing together, and it's something that brings people together. So to marginalize any group of people within that is the antithesis of the spirit of sports from my perspective.
Anthony says right now she's taking the time to listen before making any decisions about the upcoming races in the area.
On the one hand, I don't want to do nothing, but also I don't know that reacting with the first thing that comes to mind is also the best course of action.
For Erin Ayala, canceling her cycling team's plans to visit Arkansas was an easy decision.
We were planning on going to the Joe Martin stage race, which is another large race in Arkansas, and have since taken that off of our calendar.
The Joe Martin stage race has been taking place in and around Fayetteville since 1978 and has grown into one of the top road races in the country. The event is scheduled for August, but Ayala says she and her team have a straightforward motto.
All of us or none of us. And we really do stand by that in the sense that if we have one person on the team who does not feel comfortable moving forward with a sponsorship, for example, with a certain company, if we don't feel comfortable going to a training camp somewhere, or if someone has a really strong reaction to something, we're not going to do it, because it's really important to make sure that everyone on the team is truly valued and heard. And that means that we have to make some difficult decisions.
Ayala is a sports psychologist, racer, and co-founder of the Stamina Racing Collective out of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
We have right now 11 femme, trans, women, and non-binary racers, and our sole purpose and mission is to diversify cycling. We were formed this past summer in the wake of the George Floyd murder here in Minneapolis, and realizing that we really wanted to be part of the solution when it comes to social justice. And cycling is a sport that is very white and very male, and we want to be a part of the effort to change that.
On International Trans Day of Visibility, which takes place every year on March 31st, the Stamina Racing Collective released a statement calling on USA Cycling to put pressure on the UCI to relocate the Cyclocross World Championships to a different state and to refrain from sending Team USA to the race unless it's been moved.
And so I think, you know, it's one thing to say, we hear you, you're a valuable member of our community, but it's another thing to take actions to show that trans folks can actually compete in these events. It's, you know, they talk about the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so this is our effort to have them really practice what they preach.
And Ayala encourages other cyclists to speak on the matter as well.
I think it's a call for all of us to remember that we have power in numbers. And so if we have, and we have a really strong voice as consumers and as athletes in the field and the industry. And so if we all collectively call for change, we might see it.
Ayala says it's important to send Arkansas lawmakers a message to stop legislating decisions that should be guided by healthcare providers and researchers who work with trans adults and children.
When I think about the LGBTQ youth who I work with in sport, they undoubtedly face more stressors and concerns because of their identities, and we need to support them because of it. We can't remove sport, and we can't force them to be someone they're not. And so I think I am very concerned about the mental health of the trans youth in Arkansas right now. The depression, the anxiety, the suicidality, I'm very concerned about what's going to happen.
Amateur cyclist Renee Hoffman is also from Minnesota.
My two main disciplines right now are cyclocross and mountain biking. I help run a mountain bike series here locally in Minnesota. I'm a mid-pack amateur cyclist. Once in a while, I'll have like a great podium race, but mostly I'm just really involved in the community, like helping to throw races and organizing different community events around cycling.
And like Ayala and the Stamina Racing Collective, Hoffman too has canceled her visit to Arkansas, especially after having the past year to think about how she approaches racing.
Which promoters do I want to support? What types of events do I want to support? Where am I going to spend my money and energy and resources?
Hoffman plans to take part in one of a series of roundtables USA Cycling is holding over the course of the next few weeks in response to the more than 100 pieces of legislation targeting trans adults and children that have been filed or passed in Arkansas and nearly 30 other states.
And the questions that I'm going to ask them are, one, if they're willing to move this event. If not, why? I'm going to ask them what they're doing to make sure that their certified coaches, clubs, teams, race promoters, et cetera, are how they're including trans people and what they're doing to make racing safe for trans people, especially in states like Arkansas now.
Hoffman says she understands moving an event the size and scope of the World Championships isn't easy and could impact communities that don't necessarily align themselves with the legislation coming out of Little Rock.
But I think if it's what needs to happen in order to get this legislation repealed or changed, then hopefully they can pull through, and hopefully like a big flood of people will return to the area for tourism purposes, like once it's changed.
So far, neither USA Cycling or the UCI have made any mention of altering their support for the events in Fayetteville. So track cycling Masters World Champion Veronica Ivy had this recommendation for organizers.
I would fly as many trans flags as you possibly could. And I would have messaging that even though you're holding this event, you are doing it under protest about this law. You do not believe in it. You support trans athletes, and make it as loud and visible and just make it like trans pride at your race event.
And she wants trans people, from athletes to children, to know this as they pursue any of their passions.
Whenever a marginalized social group's rights have made significant gains in a fairly short period of time, which has happened for trans people in the past 10 years, we've seen a moment of severe backlash in society. And I believe we are in that moment of backlash, but it is a moment. It's a moment that could last years, but it will end. And I do think we are nearing the end of it.
Brooke Watts, who is the race director for the Cyclocross World Championships, released a statement after Governor Asa Hutchinson signed the Fairness in Women's Sports Act last month. Watts wrote, quote, "This bigotry and harm on the part of the governor and state legislature completely contradicts the community I've gotten to know in the past 36 months. And now, more than ever, we are committed to creating an event that is safe and affirming to our LGBTQIA athletes, spectators, and staff." For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
Tomorrow, in part two of our report, we'll hear from the president and CEO of USA Cycling, as well as event organizers like Experience Fayetteville and advocates like NWA Equality about how they're approaching calls for a boycott of the events in Northwest Arkansas. We've also included links to full interviews included in this story at ozarksatlarge.com.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On today's program, we will check in on the Arkansas Community Foundation. The statewide nonprofit is celebrating its 45th anniversary this year, and now has more than $500 million in assets under management. Roby Brock has an interview with President and CEO Heather Larkin. We'll have that after the break, plus some of the other top news from the past week on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
With over two decades of experience with the Arkansas Community Foundation and over 10 years as president and CEO, Heather Larkin has been front and center helping nonprofits in Arkansas navigate the COVID-19 pandemic. In a recent interview with Roby Brock, Larkin discussed the nonprofit environment the past year and what's ahead.
The Arkansas Community Foundation, 45 years in the making, nearly a half billion in assets. Tell me what you guys have been doing right. What's the niche that you guys have filled over the last 4.5 decades?
Well, I tell you, it's been amazing. 45 years ago, a group of statewide leaders came together to form this thing called the Community Foundation. And it was just a glimmer in their eye on the impact it would have. But it was all about capitalizing on local people, local philanthropy, and building Arkansas through charitable giving. And here we are 45 years later with a half a billion in assets and with a grant-making history that is, you know, rich and has made an amazing difference in our communities across the state.
Tell me a little bit about what the last year has been like. The governor pulled you guys in for this pandemic grant process. I think you guys maybe did three rounds of grant making out of all of that. For folks who have not been able to keep up with it from the 10,000 foot level, tell me what all you guys did over the last year and what's been kind of the impact.
Well, COVID definitely gave the Communities Foundation an example of what a community foundation can do. We are not a disaster relief organization, but we are responsive to our communities. So last year, March 13th, as the state shut down, the Community Foundation rallied. And by March 19th, we had grants going out the door. Over the last year, we made grants for COVID-19 relief in three phases. The first phase was that March 19th to April 15th phase, where we deployed 678 grants almost immediately, $1,000 grants to nonprofits just to get money in their hands to keep the doors open as demand skyrocketed. Those were pretty quick and you know, fairly simple as far as the process went. Phase two launched on April 18th. That was a little deeper type of philanthropy. We started making $25,000 grants. It lasted until June. We ended up making about 120 grants in that grant cycle for ongoing economic needs, a little deeper healthcare, food security, schools. And then finally, we started phase three in the end of June and continue a little bit. We still have a little grant making going out where we started digging deeper into some of the bigger issues, making grants for housing, for small businesses, really targeting communities of color. And we've made about 40 grants of about $500,000 in that phase. So overall, we have made nearly $3.2 million in grants, just responding simply to COVID, just trying to help communities, small businesses, and nonprofits respond to their constituents.
You guys have recently got a $1 million funding from Facebook to reach out more to the African American community in some ways. Tell me how that money is going to be spent and when will we see activity on that front?
We're really proud of that. Facebook has a very large commitment to Black communities, and we were contacted by them. We did not apply for a grant, but they called us because of the reputation of the Community Foundation and then because of the Little Rock metro area and some of the demographics that they had researched there. So we did receive $1 million from Facebook. We are calling it the Building Black Communities Fund. We have convened a group of Black leadership, mainly partnering with the Arkansas Black Philanthropy Collaborative. They're running the initiative. They're making all the decisions on that, and they will be making grants of that money. Probably the RFP will go out here in the next month or two, I would say April or May. We hope to have those grants awarded in early summer to Black-led and Black-serving nonprofits in the Little Rock Metro. It was restricted to the Little Rock metropolitan area.
Okay. When do things get back to normal, post-pandemic normal for the Arkansas Community Foundation? You get back to the business of what you've done for 44 years before this most recent year.
We're ready to get back to whatever that normal is. We'll continue to support our nonprofits doing this work. You know, COVID will have implications for all of us for, you know, years to come. But we've done good work and we're ready to get back to solid grant making. We've got a lot of things on the horizon, not only our Building Black Communities Fund. We've got an initiative in food security that will be statewide. We're going to continue our work in the Excel by 8, which is the grade level reading work that we do. And then just working with great Arkansans, wealthy and not, to make a difference in their communities.
And that is Heather Larkin, President and CEO of the Arkansas Community Foundation, which helps manage charitable endowments and direct local giving efforts for interested individuals and entities throughout the state. You can learn more at arcf.org. In other news this week, residential building permit activity in Northwest Arkansas's four largest cities is ahead of last year's pace through the first 2 months of 2021. And that's good news for a market that is lacking inventory. According to permit data from each city, there were 229 residential permits issued through February in Bentonville, Fayetteville, Rogers, and Springdale. That's up 8.5% from the same period of 2020. Arvest Bank kicked off its 11th annual Million Meals initiative this week, and it continues through May 29th. The campaign's goal is to provide at least 1 million meals to those in need, and it benefits more than 90 selected organizations throughout the bank's four-state footprint. And Hellion Bikes, that's a bicycle manufacturer from Seattle, has relocated its business operations to Northwest Arkansas. The owner says he plans to set up shop along one of Bentonville's existing trails, but declined to offer any specifics right now about where or an opening date. We will, of course, report those important details when they are available. For those stories and more, visit nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can keep up with our reporting of business news each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. Food and Wine is placing two Ozarks-based chocolate makers on its list of the 50 best in the country. Markham and Fitz in Bentonville is cited for its imaginative and beautifully packaged chocolate bars. Oskenozie Chocolate in Springfield, Missouri is noted for its salted Swedish black licorice and dark milk blended chocolate bars. The full list can be found at foodandwine.com. Alumni Field at John Brown University will be one of the 10 hosts for the 2020 NAIA Women's Soccer National Championships opening round. Yes, it's 2021, but the tournament is being held now because of COVID-19-related delays last year. Matches will be held April 15th and 17th. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team completed a two-game sweep of the Little Rock Trojans yesterday. Arkansas improved to 24-4 with the 10-3 win. The number one Razorbacks will begin a weekend series at Mississippi on Friday night. Fayetteville will host the Oz Trails Pro Cup this weekend and next. Some of the top mountain bikers from around the country and from around the world will be participating. The event will be at Centennial Park tomorrow through Sunday, and then again April 16th, 17th, and 18th. Spectators can attend for free. A full schedule and more information can be found at experiencefayetteville.com. And tomorrow on Science Friday on KUAF, up to a third of people who get COVID-19 are left with chronic health effects. The life of a COVID long hauler can be frustrating, but treatment may be possible. Plus, a daring giraffe rescue in Western Kenya puts the spotlight on the silent extinction of this charismatic animal. That and much more on Science Friday tomorrow from 1 to 3 on 91.3 KUAF.
This is Ria Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. We opened our segment today with Lily Boulanger, Dans ma tête d'après temps, of A Spring Morning, a masterful tone poem depicting the beauty and promise of a spring morning. Lily Boulanger, French composer and the younger sister of the noted composer and composition teacher Nadia Boulanger, was the first woman to win the Prix de Rome for composition in 1913 at age 19. But her career was tragically cut short when she passed away at age 24. This work is full of energy and vibrancy, in the best style of the fashionable style of her time, Impressionism. This excerpt is performed by the Seattle Symphony under the baton of Christian Masaralu. That was a Seattle Symphony conducted by Christian Maseralu, interpreting Du Matin de Printemps, of A Spring Morning, by French composer Lily Boulanger. British composer Jonathan Harvey wrote Bird Concerto with Piano Song in 2001 as a work for solo piano and an ensemble of 17 players. In this composition, Harvey incorporates his digital recording of California's birds. Harvey says, quote, "Birds embody not only the joy of endless singing, but also the freedom of the body's flight. The orchestra, like the birds, would have to wing its way through the bright air. Birds also use quasi-electronic frequency modulation in their cries and songs. I took their hint and copied their tricks in the electronic modulations of the orchestra," end quote. Let us welcome those birds and the spring season with Hideki Nagano, piano and electronic soloist, and the London Sinfonietta, conducted by David Atherton, performing Bird Concerto with Piano Song by Jonathan Harvey. Inspired by the beginning of the new season, today in Sound Perimeter, we are listening to pieces about spring. We close our segment today with Chinese composer Cheng Yi. Born into a musical household in China but forced to work in the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, Cheng Yi is one of the several expatriate Chinese composers who in the 1990s and early 2000s brought some of the sounds and instruments of China into the vocabulary of Western orchestras, particularly in American concert halls. Her piece, Spring Festival, captures the spirit of the Chinese New Year and all the traditions that accompany this celebration. This piece is performed and recorded by the University of Minnesota Players under the direction of Craig Kirchhoff, Jerry Lockhart, and Emily Threinen. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Penimeter.
This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us. Remember, if you ever miss a daily edition of our program, just ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large, and then you'll hear the most recent edition of our show.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Lincoln. We are a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Thursday edition of our program included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Leah Uribe. Our show and today's edition of Sound Perimeter produced by Timothy Dennis at his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can find out more at talkbusiness.net. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. We return with a work week ending show tomorrow at noon, and we're always there for you online at ozarksatlarge.com. We're also available as an absolutely free podcast. You can subscribe through any of the major podcast distributors. And you can find out more about KUAF, including finding a schedule of all of the programs 91.3 offers at KUAF.com. From the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Please take care of yourself as you are able. We'll talk again soon.